I'm still on the topic of gratitude, which Angie also talked about yesterday. And as it happens, action or activity, which she talked about. And I also want to bring up the precepts, because Dennis is having a Jukai ceremony tomorrow morning. And I think I want to say a few things about the Prajnaparamita in there too, so that's why I'm telling you ahead of time. At least you'll know my intention. I was saying before I think I said I can't bow deeply enough during the homage to the ancestors after the Prajnaparamita. It's nice to be able to do a full prostration and just remain down there for part of it, for a long part of it. It's like disappearing. And then you get up, pop right up. We say that at the end of the Prajnaparamita, I think, because this is one reason, could be that their wisdom and compassion of our ancestors, of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and all our ancestors, is extending, as the Prajnaparamita says, in 10 directions, meaning all directions, in past, present, and future. And so we get a chance to acknowledge that. As in our sitting, we're acknowledging that as well. Realizing it. Really feeling it though, in sitting, that it's boundless compassion and the directions are all pervading. Which means it includes us sitting here. Of course, it can't exist without that, because we're part of it. I don't remember if it was before or after, Angie gave me the priest ordination, she suggested that we read Gyoji together by Dogen, one of his fascicles, and we get to study together over Skype, which is just wonderful. And because I live in San Diego and I only come up here for sesshins. But so we read just endless stories, it seems like are we ever going to get through with Gyoji? But one ancestor after the other, and going off to the monastery and enduring all kinds of hardship and deprivation, and wanting to go hide away where no one can find them. And when someone finds them, they go further into the forest, into the mountain. I think there was one, I think it was in Gyoji, where one of the ancestors was, I don't remember where it was. I picture it in a kitchen, but I don't know. And a deva or a demon, either way, appeared before the priest. And he said, "Oh no, my practice has been so poor that the God has appeared before me." Wonderful stories like that. Sitting in the monastery, and the monks, after spending almost a whole winter with snow coming literally down on the platform they sat on, finally getting the gumption to ask the master if maybe they could fix the hole in the roof. And they were told, "No, we don't need to waste money on that." All of them, as I started, and I said it was long, luckily, because as I was reading and I thought, what does this have to do with me? For one thing, I'm lazy and not very tough. I am stubborn. And what was there was their intention was so strong. And that's what eventually came through, as their intention was so strong. And it was cumulative, the feeling of it, reading that. That after a while, for months and months afterwards, I kept thinking of them and feeling that feeling, and just feeling so much their compassion, not their wisdom and their compassion, and really feeling it extending. To now, to all directions, to everything. And I said to Andy, "Those old guys," he said it very affectionately, just thinking of him. I keep thinking of those old guys. That was another thing about them. They were all guys. but I didn't say that. And just feeling them so present and feeling so much gratitude that I wanted to read it again. And we started, and after the first little bit, I said, "Well, maybe we could do something else," as it was just going on and on. It was going to take another 6 months, I knew. But my respect, gratitude, didn't extend that far back or as deeply or widely when I was younger. I think I said that before. I guess I felt gratitude as much as a 26-year-old could. But it was abstract. The ancestors were clever and wise, and they had all kinds of great intention, and their practice I knew I was grateful for, and the teaching, yes. But the stories were still of someone else and another time. And I wasn't as respectful as really was required. It was kind of like a game that you play with your friends, you know, giving koans to each other and making up answers. When I heard those stories. So one night, Copen was, who knows what the lecture was about. I never could remember afterwards, but this part I remember because he he was telling a story of one of our ancestors who had been at the monastery for many months, had had his burning question, and finally really not giving up, but really unsatisfied, had to leave. He just left, as sometimes we may feel like doing when we're in sesshin. And as he was walking down the path, he tripped on a stone that was in the path, and he goes, "Yikes! What caused this pain?" All those things happened simultaneously with this experience he had, Copen said, and he was suddenly enlightened. And I was brash enough to raise my hand and say, "Well, his enlightenment, how long did that last?" I think I was really not that cynical, but I sort of feigned that world-weary air. How long did that last? Like, yeah. And he leaned forward with his stick, like he always did, and looked right at me and said, "It is still going on." It was very serious. I was seriously rebuked, actually. And I turned white. He said, "What's happened to you? You look white as a ghost." But that's where I was then. And then I've had all these years to mature, I guess. I was looking for books, you know. I wanted to find Gyoji, and then I thought, no, I wanted another book, another book I'd been reading lately on the Heart Sutra. But anyway, while I was looking for that, I picked up a book edited by Fran. I always want to say O'Connell, Fran Carney. And in the foreword or introduction, she said that in Japan, this is just what she said, people are not encouraged to study Dogen until they're over 60. I had never heard that before. But it's around that time, or probably before, that I recommenced a study of Dogen that I was very also enthusiastic about in my 20s. And that's in this part of reading Gyoji. Was more personal and less abstract. Much less abstract. I guess that's why I say those old guys. So I didn't find a book, and Mike offered to let me peruse his bookshelf. And I actually opened it practically right up to Gyoji. It's lucky because it had a different name in the table of contents. And also luckily, Michael made notes. So from here on, I'm safe. He has the translation of Gyoji, which I never broken down, you know, the way we like our teachers to do, to break down the Japanese, and it's always several things in one word. And Gyo, he for that he wrote Activity. And G, Precepts. So I was happy to see that because I wanted to talk about the precepts or at least bring it up. So I guess I'm really lucky. So, Gyoji. Translated Kaz Tanahashi as continuous practice. And that was what I was trying to find a way to say about our ancestors and the Buddhas and our teachers, this continuous practice and our continuous gratitude and our continuous practice. And I just want to read a couple things. The first sentence, on the great road of Buddha ancestry, there is always unsurpassable practice, continuous and sustained. It forms the circle of the way and is never cut off. And then later, a little bit later, by your continuous practice, the continuous practice of all Buddhas is actualized, and the great road of all Buddhas opens up. Your continuous practice creates the circle of the way. Thank you. Now, do we get to hear Angie?
No. There might be some questions.
There might be some discussion.
Yes, discussion.
First, I hope you will forgive me, homegirl, for telling you how proud I am of you.
Both ways.
Second, I want to ask a housekeeping question so I can get out of the way of the interesting questions. In service, the Metta Sutta follows strictly upon the heels of the Heart Sutra, which we chant. Are we chanting or speaking the Metta Sutta?
We appear to be speaking the Metta Sutta. Although I have heard us chant it once or twice too. I think there's more to your question, but...
The reason I ask is because 2 Augusts ago, at the suggestion of Mado, I got the impression that we agreed to chant both.
That was then.
That's my confusion. And I understand that can be forever ago, an issue like this.
We didn't deliberately ignore that. We just fell into doing it this way, and Angie can do it however Angie wants.
I'm confused.
Good.
It's a Theravada Sutra, and it's not usually chanted in the Japanese Zen tradition of chanting. And so it's been picked up by some of the Soto Zen people and turned into a Japanese Soto Zen chant. and added bells for offering incense in the way that we do with other sutras in the Zen tradition. But I wanted to respect the Theravadin tradition. Since that's where it came from, I thought we should keep it there. And so that's the way we've been doing it.
Speaking.
Speaking.
As opposed to chanting.
Yes.
Thank you.
Along that line, I had one flash of Angie telling us maybe 5 or 10 years ago that the Prajnaparamita Sutra was the diagnosis. The Metta Sutra was the prescription.
Well, we express our gratitude for both, I believe.
We do go together.
Jane? Luckily, I asked Angie that question just a week ago. Well, we'd had this, as I said, we practice in a Vipassana Sangha, and they range a little further into the social topics and in very enriching ways. This particular talk we had a couple weeks ago, I found rather too spirited, and because it was introduced as the extinction of the species is happening tomorrow, like that sign, kind of, and what are we going to do about it? That was the question posed to us, and it got very, very contentious, and, well, not very, to me, contentious, and all the time I had that in my mind. Well, is it just the humans that we have to worry about here, the extinction? And beyond that, what will still go on? And this isn't an answer. It wasn't really an answer. I'm not trying to pin Angie down, but it was. I said basically the same thing. But it was thinking of that if there, you know, if sometime there comes a time when our practice as we know it is extinguished, you know, they talk about the great fire, and I said, I think, won't there be a way? It's kind of a question. Speculation, won't there be a way that it will continue? So I'm not going to answer for Angie. Unless she wants me to.
Answer for yourself.
I'll answer for myself because I agreed with her. I said, yes. At the same time, I don't know. I said yes, because I don't know what our practice is, and I don't know who we are, and so I know, I believe in it being continuous.
You make me think, too, that really it's not a question of in the future.
She's out of time. Here it is. Thank you, Jane. David.
On this topic, Dennis loaned me a book the other day where some color was. You remember the title and the author, probably. And it's Writing a History of Buddhism for Westerners. Indian name. I was surprised at the end of the book, he said, and so the Buddha imagined even that the Dharma would disappear at a certain time in the future, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, I hadn't thought of that. And my thoughts went maybe then or maybe just now, I don't recall. But then what about this formless field of benefaction that pervades the universe as Buddha nature? It seems not species specific. And to me, in those terms, there's a little comfort in it, though.
Mm. Are you talking about end of suffering?
Is that what remember the author's name?
No.
The end of suffering, it sounds like a light like title, you know.
Thank you. Oh no, are we going to rehash our whole Sangha discussion? I'm just kidding. Yes.
Right now, I mean, most recently at home, I am reading a book by Shohaku Okumura called Living by Vow, and it, so far, I'm not too terribly far into it, is talking beautifully about continuing practice. And most recently, he said that Dogen, reflecting on the practice of a monk whose name escapes me, not Bodhidharma, but similarly went up in the mountains and lived in a cave, and didn't worry about building a big temple or having a lot of gilt altars and things like that, which he actually said is can sometimes be kind of a problem in Japan today, where fantastic temples apparently are built and they're only used occasionally for group gatherings and there are no monks in residence practicing. And he wanted to point out, Dogen did, reflecting upon this monk who preceded him, that our vows are not promises, you know, per se, so much as an ardent and fully aware intention. And that our practice, our individual practice, is like raindrops. Because he said, consider the rain at midnight in the winter, and living in that cave. And he said, you know, in the winter snow, the animals don't even go out. So that was his simple intention, his vow, manifested by that living intention. And said that as raindrops can go through moss and stone, and that individually our practice may seem small and isolated and weak and impotent, but together our practice is strong, and even beyond that, our individual continued practice is like raindrops, which ultimately can pierce moss and stone.
Thank you. I really like cans of worms, so I'm going to make a comment. You, when Coben told you that the guy who wasn't watching where he was walking,
that's one way to put it.
His enlightenment is still going on. If that would be true, then wouldn't it also make sense that it would continue, that there are practice, and that that, you know, there is no end in that sense, the way that we like to imagine there are endings to things, that it'll just continue. If the enlightenment continues, then wouldn't the practice?
Of course, I don't know. That's the way it feels. And that's the way I believe, but I mean, they might call it something else, you know, the grasshoppers.
We're getting ready for the shoeso ceremony.
I know. Come on, the shoeso ceremony will be on Saturday.
Warm up, yeah. Wait, do you mind turning on the light so we can? I can hear better.
So is it important for us to be concerned about that? What we were just talking about. Whether it continues or not, is it something to be, because there's things that are, you know, we should or need to be concerned about, and some it's not taking the importance out of the practice and keeping it going.
Right.
That's the most important, maybe. And so I'll go back to the same question. Is it something to be worried about if we don't think about it?
Well, are you referring to that talk I was in our Sangha in San Diego?
I don't know the talk, but
The thing about the species of extinction, and then that's
yes,
how.
Yes, yes, yes.
Well, after the talk, actually, I was kind of worried about maybe I should be more concerned. And then I realized,
what are you concerned about?
You say, is it worry? Should we worry about being concerned?
But what would happen?
Well, what I'm trying to say is, I did feel that I was worried that I should be concerned. And then I thought, well, I am concerned. And there are so many of us and making so many offerings, and there were in that particular group several people that were doing things and wanted to do more, and of course if they organize it, I will join in. And I, of course, am doing what I can. I didn't want to make, in the old-fashioned sense of the word, an apology at the time in our group by saying, well, look, you know, it's hard work sewing this robe, or something like that, you know, because it's something that I feel like we're doing sitting here because we're doing everything while we're sitting here. And that's not to say which path each one of us takes when we get up. That's all I can say. You know, I didn't have an answer in at the time, and I don't have one now. I'm sorry.
This was the question that came up in our...
That's what I'm saying. It's still coming up. I know I couldn't avoid it. But Laura has her hand up, David. Yes?
Thank you. I think it's the same question, similar to the question that Sammy is asking, which is, how will this awareness change how I'm sitting now?
I'm not being abstract.
I'm
not. You're asking me that question, and this answer I'm giving you isn't an abstract answer.
Uh-huh.
It is already changing how you're sitting, and you are changing it while you're sitting. That's what "it is still going on" means.
That part I understand.
Okay.
But tying into Jane and San Diego Sangha and Samia, and I think it's for both you and Angie, is, will we do anything different right now if tomorrow we're extinct?
I'm afraid that is abstract for me. For me. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm saying. There are different people who have different paths. Yeah, I mean, I'm just saying that's why I can't answer it. I'm not saying that's not a good question. And it's, I think it is most of us have that question, but maybe Angie has something to say.
No, I think that's plenty.
What can I say? Change the subject.
Actually, I've never met you before, and I just was curious. You said you have a sangha in San Diego. Could you just tell me a little bit about what you do in San Diego?
Oh, sure. It's fun to talk about our sangha in San Diego. We sit at our friend's house, Rick and Margo. They were here at one session.
Yeah. I ask you their names.
I think it was when I was lay ordained. They were here. And then Margo got really, really sick, and she was planning to come to my priest ordination, and she couldn't come. But anyway, Rick is an ardent Vipassana practitioner, and Margo doesn't call herself anything except maybe a pantheist. But so therefore, you know, Margo's wonderful. And so it's their home. And I guess Margo originally didn't sit, but they came over anyway, and she had to go in the other room, apparently, and it was David and Rick, am I right? And that was, what, 20 years ago or more? Yeah, probably more. Anyway, I joined in probably about, 12 years ago or something. I don't remember. Because a friend of mine was going to that group, one of my friends and poetry students. So, yeah, they're Vipassana practitioners, most of them, and they do different things, which I only understand superficially. I called up and said, "Could I come?" And you know, yes, I was welcome to come. I was welcome to, you know, be a Zen person. And I got there, there was one other Zen person there at the time, Rob. And you were on a little leave of absence at that time, I think, when it first came. But it's ironic that, or karmic or whatever, that actually Rob's moved to... Port Angeles. And his teacher now is Fran Carney. And then David and I. So there were three of us. And then Dennis. And then Laura. And then there were five. And actually, Balin came after you. Well, no, he was coming and going, but he came regularly after you. No, he had been a few times. I'm sorry, Balin, you came before Laura. Whatever, says Balin. Anyway, Laura came, and because she's Laura, she got something going. And pretty soon, the five of us Zen people were able to express our Zen practice together. And we do that monthly so far with a half day, or we had a whole day sit for Rahatsu, and we invited our greater sangha of the Vipassana and people, and they came. And we're kind of all on the same page. We're all Angie students. We're going to open it up. We're opening it up to the wider Sangha.
With the tension existing in the old group, the original group, of fragmentation and denominationalism emerging, and some people not wanting, not being content with us Zennies doing something different. It has raised some denominational awareness in the original group, which mm-hmm. was presently a nice mixture of very serious and yeah. sleepers.
Yeah, and the feeling really, for me anyway, is I would never give up that Sangha. Some of my favorite people are. always that Sangha. But I think now the feeling that there, certainly we would welcome any of those people to come and, you know, sit with us and bow with us. I think it's all going to be good. I think they were threatened that they would lose us. It's a big part of it. I like to think that. Anyone else? No.